सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.
वेलकम टू सोच विचार. टुडे आई एम वेरी ऑनर्ड एंड हैप्पी टू से दैट आई हैव गॉट प्रोफेसर पॉल केर्नी from the University of Stirling. He's a well-known professor in England who has published many books on public policy, on evidence, and on many interesting subjects. So I'm very happy to hear that he can talk to us, and hopefully people in South Asia can learn from Professor Paul Kearney. Welcome, Professor Paul.
Thank you.
Professor, I'd like to take up with you a very important subject that I think is very key in our part of the world. How is public policy made? And what is policy? Can I get, first of all, a definition from you on what is policy? Because we seem to think in Pakistan, especially in as advised by donors, because we seem to be living with aid, that any project is a policy, that anywhere we spend money is a policy, and that government can intervene in everything, including my personal life, including my marriage or my children. Now, how would you define policy?
Well, normally, that's normally the question we start off with if someone is doing a master's in public policy. And mm-hmm. I normally bring up the question just to show that we can't really quite answer it. So I would start off with an example of something like the sum total of government action from signals of intent to the final outcomes. And then I would use that definition to show what was wrong with it. So, I mean, for example, if you ever talk about government action, then you would ask yourself, you know, does it include what policymakers say they will do as well as what they actually do? Does it include the effect of a decision as well as the decision itself? And then you sort of unpack the idea of government. You know, what is the government, and does it include elected policymakers and unelected policymakers? And, you know, where do you draw the line between those who make policy and those who influence it? And then you would ask yourself the classic question, you know, does policy include what policymakers don't do? Because a lot of policy analysis is about the things that policymakers could do if they wanted but actually choose not to.
But tell me, now what we hear quite frequently from people who advise on policy, and especially consultants who come to our part of the world, they tell us, for example, that good policy is to increase exports, to increase productivity, or to increase economic growth, or to increase employment. Is that policy?
It's part of one definition of policy, which is a sort of set of aims. You know, policy can be the things you want to achieve, but it's quite it's an incomplete definition because you know, to set an aim is not to achieve it. And I think if policy only includes the things that people say they want to do, you know, it wouldn't take us very far.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I remember in my economics was that there was, in fact, the first Nobel Prize winner in economics, I think, was Jan Tinbergen. And he made this very important point that policy is targets and instruments. And that you must have an instrument. Every time you specify a target, you must have an instrument, and there should be one instrument for one target. But I find that mostly now we don't talk of instruments. We talk only of targets. So it become very, very desirable to mention these targets, export growth, employment, and, you know, growth, productivity, etc., but without specifying the targets. And the media and people swallow this, and most consultants who come around swallow this, and I don't think our kids are taught the difference in policy and instrument. Is that something that you think exists, or have we changed the way we think about policy?
Well, I would certainly talk about instruments. So I think if I'm sort of, again, going through this with, you know, say, master students and that sort of thing, we talk about either policy tools or policy instruments. Mm-hmm. So tools, I think, is a kind of smaller number of descriptions of the things that governments, you know, can or try to do. So they would be kind of regulatory tools, economic incentives or punishments, education, or, you know, what sort of Hoogan Margetts would call nodality. You know, so the tool they have is to be at a hub for information. And then if we were talking about instruments, I would say, well, you know, there's quite a wide range of instruments that are relevant to public policy. So, you know, I mean, examples would be, you know, things like public expenditure, you know, government control, you know, government benefits to the population that they link to behavior, you know, like unemployment benefit. Sort of formal regulations versus voluntary regulations, legal penalties, public education, and so on. So I think that would be still part of the language I would use.
Okay. Okay. So we see then even public policy recognizes that there should be instruments and that policies should be somehow related to instruments or policy tools, and that we must be realistic in what the government can do. Now, do you think that the government can do everything in our society, or is there a role of government? Is there a limitation to what the government can do?
Yeah, there's always a limitation. I mean, I think what I start by saying to students is, you know, try and think of an area of your life that is not regulated by government in some way. But it's very difficult to do so. But that's different from saying that they actually do it successfully or they're in control. You know, they have a sort of wide range of things that they do, but it's not necessarily deep. So, I mean, I think more broadly, you would say, this would link to discussions of centralization, central government control. And I think most theories of public policy are trying to explain why there's no such thing as central government control, and that, you know, policy or outcomes seem to emerge despite their attempts to influence them.
But I see very little in public policy or economics, very little discussion on what the role of government is. So how would you define, do you teach the role of government? I mean, what is the role of the government and the role of the market? How do we look at this? Because in my part of the world, somehow we think that the government, although we've given up central planning, but we still think that the government controls everything in society and the market is a byproduct. To give you a recent example, we had an economic advisory committee in Pakistan. We still have one, sorry. We set it up because of the new government. The new government just set up an economic advisory committee comprised of many luminaries, including foreign luminaries. You've probably seen the disaster or the mess that has happened because of that. But we won't get into that. But the first meeting of the Economic Advisory Council began with this, that there's a balance of payments problem. The government, instead of going to the fund, should now control imports. And they got down to this level of detail, that the government should control cheese imports, the government should control luxury cars, the government should control luxury inputs. Now, I don't even know what luxury is. But this feeling that the government can control a crisis by means of limiting consumer behavior, is that valid or should it be done?
Well, I mean, I suppose in terms of your question about do we speak about it much, I mean, if we study it, we often speak about what the state should do by comparing what they do in different countries. So clearly, say a country like the UK has a different idea about the state market balance compared to the US. You know, one is more interventionist than the other. And I think there are a wide range of defendable models that can exist, you know, as long as they are consistent. Now, I think when it comes to things like trade, I think that might also reflect a sort of a tendency for companies to want the state to some extent to act on their behalf, you know, because a lot of this is about the contracts that companies set up with each other, and they want the state to help them, you know, to develop a certain level of certainty. So I wouldn't see that necessarily as sort of state intervention when people just want to be left alone. I think sometimes people want the sort of the benefit of a government behind them when they're making these contracts that need enforced.
Okay. Now, tell me another thing that occurs to me. How is policy made? This is something that we never discuss in economics. We seem to think that policy just comes out of nowhere. As an economist, I pronounce a policy and it's done, period. Now, how do you see, I think public policy has something to say on this. How should policy be made? And if you can, you know, describe to us, what is the process?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if you don't know the process, you know, some people use the phrase, you know, black box, where, you know, inputs go in, something happens and something comes out. The sort of classic starting point along that way of thinking is to think of the policy process as a policy cycle. And now there's a lot of debate about where the cycle came from, but it tends to be used now, at least in policy studies, as an image of the policy process that does not exist, but that we can use to compare with the real world. So the cycle idea is that you have power, fairly concentrated at the center. Central governments have all the information and resources required to do what they want, and then they simply identify problems and produce solutions through a series of stages. So they would start with agenda setting, in which they define a problem. Then they would choose a solution from many possible alternatives. Then they legitimize their choice. Then they implement, then they evaluate, and then they consider if they should continue. And that tends to be rejected as a realistic model of the policy process, even if some people would like it to be that way.
But how are agendas set? Give me an example in the UK, for example, what you think of a very successful policy. How was that made? Where was the agenda set? Who solved the problem? How was the problem solved? What was the public participation? What were the various forums that were involved?
Well, I mean, that's one of those things. It's since I'm more of an academic, I'm happy with the uncertainty. So often we debate about how you actually define success. So within a kind of policy cycle idea, the evaluation stage is fairly straightforward and it's based on scientific evaluation of clearly defined outcomes. When really the assessment of success is a political choice. It's according to what you want to happen and how close you got to. But I mean, for example, the one I've been writing about recently is that for some people or many people, UK tobacco policy control is a success story. Mm-hmm. And the success is measured in terms of how comprehensive the policy is. The measures to address smoking in the UK are some of the most restrictive in the world. And if you like that sort of thing, it's very successful. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd say that there was no clear process that you could identify to link outcomes to action or evidence. Instead, you would say that this sort of emerged over 20 or 30 years, and it really relied on two things. One is that policymakers or the most influential people understood the problem in a particular way, and that understanding shifted. In the sort of the 40s or 50s, tobacco was primarily understood as a glamorous. Smoking was a glamorous activity.
Every movie actor used to smoke, but they still do, unfortunately.
And it was economically beneficial. And even when the science came out about ill health, it was framed as personal choice. And the big change over the long term was to start treating smoking as a public health problem. And then an epidemic. So it shifted from, should the state do anything about this towards we have an urgent problem and how exactly should the state deal with it? Mm-hmm. So that would be the first major condition. The second is a much wider sense that the policymaking environment is conducive to this change. So there's sort of a collection of concepts we would use to describe that. Mm-hmm. So one would be, for example, institutions, which describes the rules that policymakers use to process policy. Mm-hmm. And the key thing there was that the health department in the UK became increasingly responsible for policymaking. Mm-hmm. And its rules were geared towards consulting with public health groups rather than the industry, and rules for evidence gathering that tended to favour epidemiological and experimental data, and it also sort of formed networks with actors who were in favour of tobacco control. Mm-hmm. The socioeconomic context became far more conducive to tobacco control over time. So fewer and fewer people were smoking. It was less of a sort of a source of tax revenue for the Treasury, and in fact, they then eventually decided that they would not seek to benefit from the tax revenue, and opposition to tobacco control fell over time. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was a sense of urgency about solving the problem, mm-hmm. and the conditions became increasingly conducive to do it. And I think that contributes to this sense of major policy change over 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Let me also ask you, let me go back, think about it. The recent policy changes that I've had some, I've been looking at in the UK, for example, you had a higher education reform very recently, or research system reform recently. Mm. I think it was 2016 or 15 or something, that there was a change in some law even. What yeah. I recall is that what happened was there was a commission in 2010. I forget the name of the commission. There was a commission which actually did the study for changing the research system, or yeah. examining the research system, or review of the research system. This council then came out with a report. That report was examined by the government. The government came out with a white paper. And then after that, there was a law enacted to bring in certain changes in the research councils and the grant-making authorities, and how do you do the competitive grant system. Is that a good way to describe the policy process? That there was a commission which examined the whole system, and then there was a white paper, and then there was a law, legal change. Is that something that we should be thinking of as a policy process, or it's not normally done that way?
It's sometimes done that way. I think it that tends to be a model that's suitable for fairly... it's actually that kind of model is quite frequently used in law reform in the UK, because they would because it's so complex, they would delegate responsibility to an expert body. They would produce recommendations, and very few people would be in a position to understand or challenge them. I mean, so higher education is slightly different, because there are far more people interested and engaged in influencing that process. So, you know, the research into reform would be one part of a wider process, I think. So certainly some of that is about, you know, a relatively uncontentious reform of research councils into one big research council, you know, which is more catered towards interdisciplinary work. You know, so you could see that was compared to most other forms of a higher education policy that was relatively uncontentious, it would be more difficult to do that kind of thing with more fundamental issues, such as how should we assess the quality of research coming out of universities. Now, that has been a constantly contentious process in which governments do commission reports, but it would be kind of misleading to say that simply those reports won the day.
But what about, I mean, things like, for example, productivity, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to improve productivity. Now, if you wanted to design a policy to improve productivity, how would we go about doing it?
Oh, beats me. I mean, I suppose part of the, you know, the preparatory phase is to try and work out what causes uptakes in productivity and how prepared a government would be to do it.
So who would do that piece of work?
Well, I mean, that's a tricky one, because if it was a fairly technical process, you could imagine a sort of government appointed economically minded bodies could do a lot of that technical work. But then there would be these key choices with productivity about which sectors to invest in and how well you treat workers while you're encouraging greater productivity. And I don't think you could leave those choices to, you know, technical commissions, because they would be about, you know, how well you paid people, how well you protect them.
So finally, tell me, what role does the university, I mean, people like yourself, I mean, UK has a very healthy university system that we all try and copy. I mean, we've been copying your UK research system for a long period of time. We haven't succeeded. Do academic debates and academic research, do these things play any role in policy making?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I'd say if we're being the kindest to academics, we would say we play an enlightenment role. You know, over the long period, we challenge and help people think about the world. But it's relatively less common for people to produce a piece of research and to have an instant impact. And I think it's the latter that some people get frustrated about. They think, well, I've just produced the best evidence out there. You know, why don't people pay more attention to it? You know, that's more of a problem.
Yeah, but look at it this way. I mean, there are many books and papers written on this, that the last century was defined by a debate between Hayek and Keynes, and then Friedman and Samuelson, that basically the debate of the big state versus the Thatcher and Reagan state was really defined by the policy debates. And that Keynes, for example, had a huge influence. Keynes formed the agency that I worked in. I mean, his thoughts led to the formation of the IMF and the World Bank, which I worked in, and which influences everything in my country or in the poor countries. So yes, academic research, etc., does play a role. Not one individual, or not, I mean, some individuals are lucky to do that, but it's the commonality of the discourse, academic discourse, does play a role, or does it not?
Yeah, it does. But I think in terms of the big thinkers, I mean, academic debate on those things would be about how influential is the source of ideas and how influential is the demand for those ideas. So Keynes would produce the same work and be embraced completely in some countries and totally rejected in others. And it's not the idea that matters there, it's the audience. So I think under the right conditions, where the audience is receptive to the work, they can have a huge impact, you know, at the right time.
So how do we make the audience receptive to the work? Any thoughts on that? Can research be more effective in guiding policy? How do we make research more effective? And I don't mean any one individual's research. I'm saying the academic discourse, which I presume should be developing new ideas or fresh ways of looking at things. How can that be made more effective?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, I suppose what I would start by saying is, there's so much research, and there's so many contradictory findings from it, that I think you could say generally that a lot of scientific research has an impact, but people are competing with each other for attention. You know, it's not that science as a whole gets no attention. It's that some people get disproportionate attention and some people get disproportionately low. So I think increasingly then people talk about, well, what advice could you give to individual organizations or people about how to make more of an impact with their own research? And the usual advice is about thinking more about how your audience consumes it. So that would be, you know, the basics, from, you know, making it accessible and written in a, you know, an understandable language, you know, with little jargon, towards thinking about how you would frame that information in terms of the way that your audience thinks about the world. You know, so that's the trickier part, about trying to understand how people engage with and understand the work.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Professor Paul. You've given us a lot of food for thought. We can see that the policy process is important. It's not an exact science, but it's an important thing to think about. And that every country must develop an organic policy system that works for it, and that allows some thought and evidence and fresh ideas to be explored and understood by society at large. And the government must be receptive to such ideas and be capable, also be itself capable of developing or absorbing those ideas and conducting a debate. So the government must be a part of the debate. And, you know, any other final thoughts?
The only thought I had is that I think if people listen to the podcast, they'll realize I'm from Scotland, not from England.
Oh, yeah, of course. Good point. Yeah, I keep thinking of UK as, you know, homogenous body. But yes, of course, being Scottish is important. And there's a separate subject, but we'll take that up. So thank you very much, Professor Paul.
Okay, thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.